This, yeah, I just lost a lot of plausible deniability, but that's okay. We might consider starting with the logical place to start is thinking about reports of tornadoes. That's we collect them as part of verifying warnings, and this is the number of tornadoes per year goes through of all tornadoes or exactly F0 tornadoes, so the weakest tornadoes that won't cause damage to much of anything unless you live in a mobile home. And that you can see there's that been a big increase from the long ago time period. If we go to just the F1 and greater, which you'll start to notice if you live in an ordinary built house, what we see is that number, there's lots of variability from year to year, but the average is about 500. We got some big years, 1973 in particular, 2011, and then some periods of low years, the late 80s, the early 2000s. This only goes through 2013. If I showed you 13 and 14 and what we preliminarily guessed for 15, they would all be down, much like what we saw in those other previous periods. But the average is 500. And so that at least gives us some idea that perhaps we're recording those somewhat better than the other things. But when we look at those averages, that masks a whole lot of stuff. And so one of the things I started looking at a couple of years ago is what's actually changed. And I was doing an interview this morning, and one of the things that the question that comes up occasionally is, what's good about being a scientist? And one of the great things about being a scientist is that brief moment of you knowing something that no one else on the planet's ever known. and you have that, wow, I've just learned something. And then your job is to share it. And this is a story of a couple of years ago, something we looked at. One of the things we just stumbled onto, and this made me feel really bad that I hadn't looked at it before, was, 500 tornadoes a year, F1 and greater. 50 is 10% of the distribution. That's kind of near the beginning of the season, but not too sensitive. And what we found was that there's been a huge increase in the variability of the starting date. If we look in the last 15 or 18 years by now, the four of the five earliest and seven out of the nine earliest have all occurred in that most recent period is the earliest starting dates for the year. And if I had 2015 now, I would actually be able to say that the six latest or five of the six latest starting dates for the year have all been in the last 18 years. And so huge changes in the variability of when the season starts. So tornadoes aren't getting earlier. Well, yes, they are getting earlier, but they're also getting later. And that's everything's happening. So the variability on this is occurring. The other thing we've seen is that almost all of our records for the most in the red and the fewest in the red or in the black tornadoes in a calendar month have all been set in the last 20 years. So that if we thought we were just doing a better job of collecting reports, you'd expect to see the maximum reports now, maximum records now, and the minimum records in the old days. And that's not what we see. We actually are seeing both extremes being occurring more often. And at the heart of it comes back to the fact that the number of days per year with at least one F1 tornado has decreased over the last 40 years, from about 150 per year down to about 100 now. And with that, remember, we have the same number of tornadoes total, 500 per year. The number of big days, we'll call that for technically it's more than 30 F1 tornadoes in a day, has gone up from about one day every other year now to where we average 3 days per year. And that includes, if you look at 2012 and 2013, which are the last dates on this chart, that includes those 2 years which were very low for total number of tornadoes. We still had a couple of big days in it, which if you go back prior to 1980, those were incredibly rare to have. We had one day before 1980 in which we had more than one day with more than 30. So that's been a big change. Fewer days, but more big days. And as we go forward into the future, some of the climate model work has focused on looking at those environments that Victor sort of hinted at. We can make a halfway decent model of where tornadoes occur by modeling the favorable environments that we want to have lots of energy for storms to form in. So that's a thermodynamic property, temperature and moisture. We want to have lots of change of the wind with height. That helps the storms rotate. And we can count those in climate models. We can count those in observations and say yes, no. And it's not a perfect world, but it's not too bad. And so with the climate models, we can actually just count the difference between future and now and get an estimate. And this is some work done by Noah Diffenbaugh and folks out at Stanford and Purdue, and the maps of how things look on the left side from the late 21st century to the 20th, minus the 20th century, red means more tornado, more environments are favorable for severe storms. Not necessarily tornado, but severe thunderstorms, so hail and high winds. Blue means fewer. The average over the entire country are these time series on the right side. And so, and for instance, in the springtime, all the model simulations, and these were the CMIP 5 simulations, all say we're going to be increasing the number of favorable environments. But if you look at the seasonality, things are really interesting. The springtime, everything is lots more stuff happening, lots more. And all over the country, there's no place except that it goes through a decrease. But if we look at the summertime, you see two messages. One is the models are all over the map. Some of the model simulations say lots more storms. Some of the model simulations say actually a lot fewer storms. And there's this, on average, there's this hole in the center part of the country where the models, in, on average, would say things are going down. The stippling you see, oops, go back. Thank you. The stippling is statistical significance, and you note there's no statistical significance in the summer because the different models disagree with each other so much. And what you're actually seeing is the models either say we get a lot more favorable environments and, boy, lots of storms, or we go into what looks like drought, the drought signal in the central plains. Big ridge over the central part of the United States, and you don't get any thunderstorms at all in the summertime. And so this signal here of seeing the blue is actually indicative of a reasonable number of the model simulations saying we'll have a drought almost every summer in the plains, which that's probably a more important thing than anything dealing with the severe thunderstorm signal. So we got a pretty good confidence in the springtime, and we don't really know what's happening quite so well in the summertime. And this is looking at large-scale models. You can take those large-scale models and just do like we do with weather forecasting on a day-to-day basis and run a high-resolution model inside of it. And we actually now have proxies in the weather forecasting world that essentially say this thing in that high-resolution model looks like a severe thunderstorm. And so Victor, as part of a paper he did last year, or this year still, I guess it is, did that for 11 springs in the 20th century and 11 springs in the 21st century and just counted up how many storms we get out that we would call in modern forecasting, we would assume that model was telling us it was severe. This is the accumulated plot, each one of the individual light lines. The heavy lines are the averages. So 20th century is the black, 21st is the red. We see an increase when we look over these heavy lines on the right side. You know, there's more storms in the simulated storms in the future. But the really interesting thing to me is the fact that the four highest years in the future are all out of, or the four highest years on all the record are all out of the future run, but at the same time, the two smallest years. So a real strong indication that the models think the variability should be increasing. We can't really see changes in the mean. But there is this lot of evidence for more variability, and the big question for us is we don't really completely understand cause effect in here. There's some suggestive stuff. It's kind of hard to think, given the time scale, that it's not somehow related to the warming of the planet, and particularly the warming of the North Poles, the North Pole. There's only one of them, yeah. But how that actually connects physically is still a little bit of a mystery to us, and that's, I think, one of the big areas we're going to be working on in the next few years to understand that.
Well, thank you all. This is fantastic. You've really laid the groundwork for our discussion, and I think I'm going to take advantage of the moderator's prerogative and just jump right into the Q&A from you all and just maybe save a few minutes at the end for a couple of questions I have. So let's just kick off, and just a reminder, the SEJ policy, questions first from members or non-member journalists, those of you with the blue tags, and then we'll open it up to more generally. So, any questions?
Radio office, I'm a freelance writer from Dallas. How much do partisans on various sides of climate change want to grab your data and say, see, it proves this, or see, it proves that? And does it prove anything about
proof is an interesting word. It is actually very interesting to see what happens when we put something out and look at the. I do a daily search on Google for tornadoes and climate change just to see what people, odd things people are saying and the odd ways they're using my data. In general, people grab on things that I've written, and occasionally it's appropriate. you know, not as often as I'd like it to be. To me, the interesting thing is the response I get, because I will not always, because it's not, I don't have that much time, but I will occasionally weigh in and say, you know, you've incorrectly used something. And there's a set of folks that go, oh wow, I'm really sorry, let me put a correction out and let me, you know, would you like to write something for me that would actually do that? And that tends to be the more accepting of the consensus on climate change. And then another set of folks that are saying, you're just trying to make things look like they're a whole lot worse now than they were in the past. You're lying and you're trying to cheat and change the data. And that comes from a different perspective. And it's really, I can predict what answer I'm going to get, so it depends on how much do I feel like messing with people. But you know, once every few months I'll put something out that says, you know, the data set does not allow you to make that, to draw that conclusion. H.E. Brooks, 87.
I'd like to follow up, and this is for any of you. Do you think it's worse or better to have this increased variability? And if so, why? In other words, does it increase or decrease public risk?
That's part of the other question. Besides the cause and effect, you know, who cares, has been the question I ask myself a lot. And, I mean, do you care if your house got hit by on a day when there was one tornado or when there was 30 tornadoes? And the answer is you do a little bit. Because when you get hit on the big day, everybody else is competing for that same stock of plywood to rebuild their home, and so the prices go up. My wife and I noticed that we made a mistake that we didn't dream we were making, and we waited a year too long to do the remodeling on our house. And Katrina happened in between, and we suddenly were paying 20% more for materials than we would have if we would have done it the year before. The people who I think care are people like FEMA and maybe state emergency management that have to deal with what resources do we need to have available to recover. And resource recovery from a large event is a lot harder than from single events. And then insurance companies and reinsurance companies that have to deal with, you know, how do they manage just the portfolio and capital management to move funds around if they need to pay out, you know, $5 billion in one shot. That's a whole lot different than paying out, you know, $500 million over 10 separate events. That's just a, you know, financially, that's a different set of challenges, and there's some contractual arrangements that make it. So I think those are the folks that really care. I'm not sure if it matters a whole lot to individuals. Might matter some to forecasters in terms of how they, you know, they deal with big events are typically easier to forecast. And so that may make them slightly better attuned in terms of making that kind of forecast.
I would say maybe at the local scale, the variability makes it a challenge for complacency of local folks. So, right, you have two or three years in a row, maybe where you have high activity levels of tornadoes across the United States, and there might be a heightened awareness, right, for next year to sort of be prepared and be ready. But then you go, if you look at the past three or four years, just in the United States, since 2011, very low numbers, and maybe we're getting back to sort of a complacent population in terms of tornado risk and vulnerability. Now, certainly that changes when you're looking at outbreaks versus consistent activity, but maybe that's one way that it might translate to the local scale.
And I'll follow up on that to look at the seasonal component of this. As you expand the time when you might expect tornadoes into, you know, very early spring and then later into the summer in places where they were used to, more accustomed and more adapted to having tornadoes be in the a very narrow window of time, it's actually a challenge for those communities to prepare and for individuals to know when to prepare. So I know that FEMA's Preparathon, they've made significant effort to try to time activities in places where it's most relevant. That's going to increase the challenge that they're facing quite a bit.
It reminds me of the fact that most locations, NWS offices around the country have severe weather awareness weeks, and often scheduled in, say, January, February in the Deep South, and then it gravitates northward. And how many times has there been a severe weather outbreak the week before the awareness week?
I was wondering first, do you think the media and the general public makes a good enough distinction between hurricanes and tornadoes? And what's, if I following up on what Randy had to say, I mean, what's the danger of that for both sides? I mean, if you know, you're, and I think it's very good that you're making the distinction that, that you know, you're not quite there with tornadoes. When do you think, if you have any idea when you might be, but also, what does it mean for, like, hurricane research? Do people just automatically say, well, they're confused about tornadoes, ergo they're this research of climate change and hurricane, which is the most, you know, most useful.
Yeah, that's a boy. I mean, we have zeroth order understanding of what we think is going to happen in the tornado world. As global temperature goes up, the energy available for storms will increase, but also the organization of storms, so the wind shear, which is related to temperature gradients between, say, the equator and the pole, that's going to decrease as the pole is warm more. And so we've got one ingredient that becomes more favorable and another becomes less favorable. And that's actually where our real problem is exactly how that balance plays out. The hurricane community has a different set of challenges in that they have to deal with. And I think one of the object lessons that the hurricane people got involved in climate in a public way before we did. And in fact, I remember, if anybody who was there, I think it was the 2006 AMS annual meeting, where I couldn't get in room to see the almost fist fight between different people because the room was already full. And Chris Lancey happened to, who's the science and operations officer at the Hurricane Center now, and our careers for a long time really paralleled each other, came up to me at that meeting and said, you know, someday somebody's going to come in the tornado world and there's going to be some big event and people are going to jump on it, do climate change, and make a lot of noise about it. And you need to be prepared for when that day comes. And we don't have the same mix of personalities in the climate, in the tornado, in the severe storm, and the hurricane world. But at that meeting, I knew there was a few people who were interested in it. Tony Del Genio, Jeff Trapp at Purdue at the time. And we kind of had that conversation about, you know, we're not going to get into public shouting arguments with each other. We may not agree on everything all the time, but we're not going to get up on stage and, you know, say, "Victor, you idiot." You know, that's just not going to be something we're going to allow to happen. And so we've been, I think, a little more cautious in how we've approached it. I mean, because the hurricane community, as I've watched them from the outside, you know, there were some very dramatic statements made early in the hurricane climate thing. That now nobody believes some of the, in fact, people who wrote the papers appear not to even remember that they wrote that paper. And so I think that's been, you know, from the inside, I think, okay, that's the way science works. You know, we fight and we argue and we do things and we do, hopefully, do politely. We've gone through a slightly different trajectory because we watched what happened to our friends in the hurricane community. And I think we've managed to stay, you know, up front, we'll tell you, you know, I don't understand what's going on with this. And I'd like to, I think I've got some ideas on the change, but it's not ready for the real world. There's, you know, lots of, you know, almost smoking guns, but no cause-effect relationships. And I think we've tried to be more cautious. That a lot of that has to do, I think, with the personalities in the community. But it's it is interesting that people sort of assume, and even our friends in the climate community, the word extreme has a lot of meanings. You know, is it a rare event? You know, this is the 99th percentile or higher event. That's in some sense extreme. But then, you know, a tornado, which we have over 1,000 a year. Well, at an individual point, that's a very extreme event if it happens to your house. It's a relatively ordinary thing. But that, you know, do we talk about that event as extreme versus the 1% kind of thing, and we convolve those two words in meanings, even though they actually go in very different directions. And when people say extreme events will increase in frequency, we aren't actually saying tornadoes are going to be increasing in frequency. Most of that has to do with, you know, temperature extremes and drought extremes. And I think that people jump on the word extreme and do real violence to the richness that the English language has.
I mean, yeah. it seems very logical that you've got a slow-moving thing that can fly a plane over and track versus something that's a fluke in nature that's very fast-moving and dies within minutes, but the only common denominator is a storm. Yet, when you see documentaries like video montage, you'll see tornadoes mixed together.
Yeah, yeah, and you know people ask me about hurricanes. I'm not a tropical. I've never had a tropical meteorology class. I know that it's warm near the equator, and it's wet a lot of the time in some of those places. And you know, there's not much change of the wind with height. And if there's no, keep tweeting away. And, you know, as a severe storms guy, I live for high wind shear days. You know, and my tropical friends hate them. And, you know, I don't even understand how tropical meteorology works very well, because, and I don't care, because I don't think it's very interesting. But I mean, the physical systems are so different that there's, from a meteorologist standpoint, there's no reason to expect them to behave in the future in any, you know, for the changes to occur anywhere. You know, in relationship with each other.
It truly is amazing how many articles have lumped tornadoes together with other storms. And even complicating things is that there's this slight signal in hurricanes toward intensification, maybe fewer, but more intense over time in most of the climate models. So I wonder if we have any questions on the toward the shorter term to medium term seasonal end. Doyle?
I had a question about tornado warnings. You said it's about 13 minutes. Is that from the moment the warning is issued?
Sure. I'll go ahead. Okay. It's actually an artifact of the way the National Weather Service collects data. Okay. They count, if you don't put a warning out, it counts as a zero lead time. Okay? So that's the starting point. What happens is that from the time the warning is issued to the tornado begins, or if it's issued for a currently existing tornado, for when the tornado, from now till when the tornado enters the warning, the average lead time is 18 and a half minutes. Okay, so that's from warning to touchdown. If you take into a, if you count the non-events as zeros, you're really multiplying by the probability of detection. How many of the tornadoes do we actually warn on? And that's 75%, which gives you the 13 minutes. But that it's it's from I put a warning out, tornado happens.
Touch it down or spotted?
Well, it begins, yeah. And that number's been robust. That 18 and a half minutes has been robust for 30 years. It I think it has a lot to do with non-meteorological factors. It actually has a lot to do with the size of counties in the United States.
Well, why does local TV and others say a warning is when a tornado
happens? It's when a tornado is occurring or is imminent. That's the warning message. So if you're looking at radar and you go, that's about to happen, hit the button. That's, you know, we try to have warnings before the tornado occurs. I mean, that...
18 and a half minutes. How are you
going
to get that to an hour?
That's a very good question. We'll definitely circle back to that if we haven't. If we don't get another question along those lines. Next question. Could you identify yourself, please? I'd like to specifically ask him about that, since it relates in some ways to policy. And I'm reminded of the Worcester, Massachusetts tornado of 1953 that killed more than 100 people. So.
this is a great question. I don't have a ready packaged answer for addressing that. I kind of wish that I had a communications scholar on the stage. I've learned a lot from them about the difficulties that we have in talking about extremes, talking about uncertainty. The nature of all of these things are sort of convolved. I can tell you that this is an active area of research in the communication scholarly literature, and we're working right now to try to bridge that into the field of meteorology. A lot of work has been done in health that relates, and that might be a place to start.
Yeah,
So question was the difference between tornado and a supercell storm. So most what we consider significant tornadoes are tornadoes that are, you know, there's these flukes, or the real flukes of the tornadoes, the ones that are EF0 and happen maybe in, you know, 30 seconds to a minute. But most of the strong tornadoes that we see are spawned by what we call a supercell storm. So the supercell storm is just the parent, basically the storm that produces the tornado. And a supercell is special because it has a mesocyclone, which is really just a rotating area in the storm. They're quite majestic when you see them. Whether or not you're in the plains or in the East Coast, you'll kind of know a supercell when you see it. And if you watch them, the videos of supercell storms, you'll always see this sort of corkscrew turning nature of the storm. Yeah.
And often on radar, you will also see that the red, angry red area will be curving around on the southwest side often. Question in the back. Yes. Are you SH? Are you SH?
That's something that has been officially implemented by the National Weather Service and has been in place in this area. I think that our forecast office participated starting this spring, or was it last spring? This is 2015. It was this year. This is something that had started in a couple of forecast offices in the center of the country as an experimental idea, and now they're putting it out to be nationwide. So yes, that is something that's happening. I should caveat this by saying that there's a lot of controversy in the community about this program because there are a lot of questions about our ability to forecast the intensity and severity of damage. We're, you know, meteorologists and we can forecast the hazard, but there are a lot of problems due to limited observation in real time and reporting in real time, and the way that tornadoes change so quickly, and forecasting what they're going to do. And that's one side of the coin. The other side is we don't know enough about everything that is on the surface and its underlying vulnerability characteristics to be able to do this, especially in real time. I mean, that is such a tall order. And what we're starting to see in some of the work, this program was instituted starting in 2012 in those five forecast offices in the middle of the country, and they've expanded since then. What we've seen from forecasters who've been part of this program is there's a hesitancy to issue these damage tags. They are not necessarily implementing them very well, and part of it is there are a lot of insecurities about. There's a lot of uncertainty on the forecaster's part about how what message they're supposed to be conveying and their role in actually determining impacts. They don't feel comfortable doing it. So this is being evaluated by the National Weather Service right now.
Kim, could you or one of you all give us an example of what a tag, how it might read, for just a sample? You know.
Sure. Yeah. So there are three levels right now for tornado warnings. There's ordinary tornado, whatever that is. You know, just your garden variety little rotating cyclone of death. Just go outside. You know, there's birds and it's great. They've changed it to significant and catastrophic damage. Are the two tags you can put on. And the language, they've modified it slightly in the last year when they became aware that their original language would have inspired a lot of people to flee. And that has been debated in its goodness. It still reads something like areas, for the catastrophic warning, areas may be unrecognizable to survivors. I mean, this is heavy wording. The wording is still very confident. So it still expresses certainty, and it says, this will happen. And we can maybe offer thoughts on what could happen, but saying that it will is actually a very different thing, and this has been a cornerstone of part of the dispute.
And as someone who's less than excited about this effort, we don't have any idea when we say that phrase, neighborhoods will be unrecognizable, how people will respond to that. I mean, there's evidence from, you know, the her, was it Rita in or Ike?
Ike
on at Galveston, when they said, you know, people who remain will face certain death. That didn't make people evacuate. They just threw up their hands and said, well, there's nothing I can do about it. I might as well die at home. And we don't know how people will actually respond when we tell them, you know, neighborhoods will be unrecognizable. So it's not clear if the goal, and I don't know if that is the goal of the warning process, is to get actions that will get, that will reduce loss of life. I'm not sure that those messages actually go in that direction at all. Mm-hmm. I'm cynical, but that's me. I'm old.
So, yes.
So, to be clear, so I understand what you're saying. This isn't just when there's an impending coastal hazard, but you're talking about the longer term, staying in places, and you know, with things like climate change. This has been a frequent point of conversation. So this is something that touches on an area that I've started more actively research on place attachment. It turns out that people are very, very attached to the places that they live in a lot of different ways. There are economic and cultural and affective bonds that may be affecting, even in real time when hazards are occurring, how they interpret and personalize the risk to themselves. It's a challenge to try to convince people to move out of vulnerable, hazard-prone places. I know at a congressional level, there are sincere debates about what our role should be in trying to get people to do this. We need some of these places where people are living that are risk-prone and vulnerable. Mary Landrieu, when she was the senator for Louisiana and we were doing flood insurance reform, was very quick to point out that we need the Port of New Orleans. And yes, there are a lot of problems in how we have constructed that city and how we continue to reinforce the direction of the river, and we are doing a lot of environmental damage because of that decision. But it has cultural significance, it has economic significance. Our port cities are all in places that are vulnerable to climate change. And we can't do without them. And these states, these communities are going to fight for that. And we have to have affordable housing for people. So we have to, unfortunately, the way that we have set up our housing stock in the U.S., it's most of the people who live in the vulnerable areas are economically disadvantaged, and it's because that's the least expensive land. And we put multifamily housing in floodplains and things like that, but we need to also balance that interest with people need to have low-cost housing, and we need to have access. People need to live close to where they work. And in port cities, in some of these cities, you have to live in the floodplain to work in the floodplain. So there are layers of challenges, and that's just that's the economic dependency and a bit of the cultural dependency and significance and meaning. It's not as easy as it seems. And I know that there's one political perspective really, really, really wants to get people to move out of hazard-prone places, especially floodplains. And when they were doing flood insurance reform, there were Democrats who refused to sign on to the reform if there was nothing that would incentivize that. But that is actually a very challenging notion for a lot of reasons.
It's funny how I'm thinking of wildfires and how so many times people don't want to leave their house. They'll be out washing it down, and if possible, sometimes that will alleviate the fire risk. Sometimes they die. So. Of course, fortunately, tornadoes are not increasing rapidly in central Oklahoma, or we'd be talking about evacuating a large area and another resettlement like the 1930s. Any other immediate questions? I have one for Victor about the multi-week to seasonal forecasting. I'm curious how you would compare and contrast that to the efforts on hurricane seasonal forecasting. As many of you know, those kicked off in the 1980s, 1990s for Bill Gray at Colorado State University. Began issuing seasonal forecasts, and it was really kind of a regression model, a pretty basic approach, but it pretty successful in a lot of ways. And now NOAA has adopted it, so I'm interested in whether you think your research might similarly, whether there's any chance, and the NOAA folks could weigh in too, on whether NOAA might someday be telling us this will be a big tornado season. And just to bring in another angle to that, there's some interesting research from John Allen and Mike Tippett, colleagues of yours, as you know, at Columbia, who are looking at El Nino and La Nina influences on seasonal prediction. And to me, there's some cross currents with that. For example, they show that El Nino winters tend to be correlated with less tornadoes in the spring overall, at least in the southern plains, right? But there's another body of work that says that when you're transitioning away from El Nino or La Nina in the spring, that can especially from as an El Nino goes away, that can be a busy season. So how do you reconcile that?
So I'll start with the first aspect of, I think this goes back to perfectly the talk about climate change, and we're learning from the hurricane community, and that's really what we're doing in the severe storms community. So in history, the hurricane community would put out, you know, this is the number of storms we're expecting, here's a range, here's how many we think we're going to make landfall. And these are all, again, very simple models based on large-scale signals, mostly in the ocean, so sea surface temperatures. There was hesitation to do that for a long time in the severe storms community because of the time scales of tornadoes and the difficulty in predicting these things, not only 1 week, but now talking months in advance. And I think we're finally at a point in the science where we can start to maybe do what the hurricane community did and learn from them and their efforts in the 80s. And so we're getting to things like El Nino, La Nina, which are much slower scale oscillations that we can sort of use to predict. But then also bringing in things like I showed today, the angular momentum, which is, again, very much related to El Nino, La Nina. And, you know, I think we are definitely at that tipping point where we may see, hopefully, that in fact there is an effort. There was an effort out of the White House to, after the tornadoes of 2011, to really come up with these seasonal forecasts for, and to be honest, that effort has really gone away at the national level, and it's now primarily being funded through insurance companies who want to mitigate against the risk of very large tornado outbreaks. Now, that said, we did meet this past March in Washington, D.C. to come up, basically bring everybody around the table and say, you know, what's the best way to go about this? What's the best way to create a seasonal forecast for tornadoes? What would that look like? And out of that meeting basically came, let's keep it simple. Let's go average activity, above average, or below average. And some of the efforts we made this year, I think, were very successful. They were sort of a little bit under the table. You'd have to navigate to deep portions of my website to find the data. But it's there. It's available. And for those interested, and we're going to participate, we're going to do it again next year, and we're going to bring the people together. And I think once we figure out whether or not there's skill, I think there is skill, but once we sort of get to that tipping point and we know there's skill, you're going to see a much larger presence of seasonal forecasting of severe weather.
And there's a really interesting thing we've also learned from our friends in the hurricane community. It's not clear that the sort of the FEMAs and the Hurricane Center actually think that the forecasts, the seasonal hurricane forecasts, are of a really high quality. I mean, they actually, when you do an objective verification, they're okay. They're better than flipping a coin, but not a whole lot. But the one thing it gives the hurricane people the chance to do is it gives them a public platform when they issue that forecast to say, hey, remember, it only takes a hurricane at your place to be a really bad year. You should make sure you're prepared. And so we've gotten the notion from high-ranking places that even if the quality of the forecast isn't that great, that may give us a platform, say, on the 1st of March to say, you know, are you prepared? Are you ready for the event? Do you know what you're going to do? Your plan is in place. And so it may serve a really great policy standpoint without even being a really accurate forecast. And that's, you know, makes some of us a little squirmy. But, you know, that may be one of the things that really pushes us to put it out in a public way before we really think that scientifically we're ready to make a forecast that, boy, you can count on. You can make money betting on this forecast.
But just to clarify, if there's even a little bit of skill, like some of the closer-in hurricane seasonal forecasts, sure, it's a little better than flipping a coin. It's not anywhere near completely accurate. But some measure of skill is better than no knowledge, wouldn't you say? I guess it depends on your user perspective.
But. Yeah, that's the thing. I'm not convinced that we're close to that point, but that we may be close to that point for the fact that we actually can start doing instead of having these local severe weather weeks, we have a national severe weather week, and we do the, hey, you know, you need to make sure you're ready, and what do you need to be prepared? And one of the other things I think we've also learned is that if there's always a user for a product, and someone can actually find value in that product even when we think it, you know, isn't all that valuable. And that usually helps us then guide improvements in the future improvements in the product that help us actually eventually make it into a product that, you know, that we think is scientifically accurate.
Cool. So not to pin you down, Victor, but does this mega El Nino we're having this winter mean more tornadoes in the spring in this part of the country, or less, or What can we say now about the possibility?
So the El Nino state, in fact, I just make a comment on the sea surface temperatures right now globally. There are unlike anything we've ever seen, and part of it is the El Nino, but part of it you may have heard in other circles is the temperatures in the northern Pacific Ocean and near the Gulf of Alaska, which has been partly responsible for the warmth along the coastlines of the United States. But really what that's doing is changing the jet stream pattern and sort of angling the air out of Canada. And we're seeing the major population centers, Chicago, Boston, right, the big energy demand cities were actually much below normal temperatures. And so that's an interesting piece. Now, what does that mean for tornadoes, El Nino? So as we go into the winter, what you'll typically see in an El Nino situation, especially once we get to January, February, and even into early March, more severe weather activity in the southern tier of the United States. So think Texas, Louisiana, and especially Florida shows a really strong signal for above average severe weather activity. As you move into springtime, that's when you see a lot more variability in the forecast. There's some years, and again, the other thing I'll say is strong El Ninos like this one, your sample size is very small. So we only have really one or two events that even go back to say this is close to what we've even experienced. So there's uncertainty there. But as you move into spring with an El Nino, as this year, you'll typically, if you average everything out over the course of the spring, you'll typically be below average. But, right, as Harold said, all it takes is that one big event, one big outbreak, and it becomes news headlines, and then all of a sudden it's an active year for maybe one or two events. And that's the risk that you take with El Nino, because typically you'll have a stronger jet stream. This creates stronger wind shear. And you're more likely to have these big progressive severe weather outbreaks, but maybe below average as a season.
Yes.
Shelter in place. Don't evacuate. I'm at times out of step with some of my colleagues in the lab on where we're headed with some things. I guess most of the time, one of the things that we know that is historically, when there have been people have essentially built models of tornado death based on lots of variables that go in, and we can predict how many deaths we might expect out of an event. From looking at that, one of the things they found is that as you increase the lead time from 0 to about 15 minutes, the rate of death decreases. When we go beyond that, it flattens out, and there's even some new stuff which suggests that it actually the rate of death starts to increase again. And so 15 to 20 minutes appears to be right now sort of that's the minimum death rate time. Now, part of that is that, and this is one of those questions I don't really even know how to answer, is that basically that showing us that the public in some sense is attuned to the current performance status of the warning system, because that's the mean lead time, and so maybe that's just that people actually have some intuitive understanding of what that's like. So the question becomes, if we could make a longer lead time forecast that has the exact same error characteristics as our current forecast systems, would that help? We know that there's been some survey work done which has indicated if we told people you have an hour long lead time, what would you do? And they say, well, I'd wait for more information. And that may be because they know, well, really, we really don't know until we're 15 to 30 minutes. And so there's no reason to do anything because I don't because the thing's so small, and you know that, we aren't going to get any tornadoes, but just in case the most bizarre atmospheric event happens in the next 48 hours in the history of the planet, everybody in Norman knows if there's a storm at Chickasha, we may have a problem. Any place else on the planet, the storm can be, and we're okay. But Chickasha is the main place, about 30 miles southwest of here. And so maybe people do the, okay, I'm going to wait till I hear something there. Oh, the storm's in southwest Oklahoma. Well, when it gets to Chickasha, I'll start thinking about what I'm doing. And if it gets to Blanchard, holy cow, we're in the shelter. That's one of those things that I think that the, technologically, we're actually relatively close to being able to put out statements with an hour lead time that at least have some non-zero quality to them. We really have no clue what response that will generate, and that's fundamentally one of the things that I've become very concerned about, and that I have close to zero research skills in, is understanding how we can insert information into human beings' decision-making processes to lead them to make decisions in ways that we think are somehow beneficial. Because we know that there are times when there's really good times to reach people, and there are times when it really doesn't matter. In the old days of things, I remember there was the Johnstown flood in 1977 in Pennsylvania that killed 70-something people. One of the things that happened was they became aware there was a potential for a major problem overnight at about 11:30 p.m., just after the last newscast went off. So the forecasters knew we had a big problem coming, and they had lost their time to communicate. They had to be able to forecast a 14-inch overnight rain after the first half inch had fallen if they wanted to get to people, and they knew the window had passed them. And we have the same kind of thing in different ways in the tornado problem. There are times when we can reach people, and there are times when we can't reach people, and we just don't understand that yet.
I just have a quick comment on that. You could imagine, though, how very useful a one-hour lead time tornado would be for things like a hospital or a large venue, when you're trying to weigh the fact of weigh that risk component. So I'll just say that yes, probably for 90+% of people, that fact. And yeah, Harold's shaking his head because
exactly. The May 20th tornado act. That one of the hospitals actually started putting in information when they were well before a warning was issued. They didn't wait for the warning. They started their plans.
Yeah, and that's probably never more evident than the Joplin event in 2011.
So there's obviously some audience segmentation that needs to be done on this in terms of the value of this to different people. The May 31st El Reno event was an eye-opener to us, and it was a very long lead time event. And it suggested to us, when you look at models that predict human behavior, so looking at the decision-making process and the insertion points Harold's referring to, it's possible that we do not know very much about, well, we don't know very much, but it's entirely possible that people don't feel safe in their homes, for example. So the response efficacy is what this is called. We don't know what people think about their options for protecting themselves. So they may believe that they cannot survive any tornado, and they might think, oh, the tornado that's going to hit me is going to be large, and I will die. And both of those are probably untrue. You're very unlikely to be hit by EF5 damage. Even the Moore tornado, a very small part of the track was EF5 damage. You're also very unlikely to die even if that occurs. Almost everyone survives in well-built structures. The thing is, we need to reach the people who live in mobile homes, in apartments. Maybe it's more appropriate for them to evacuate, and maybe they can use lead time. But we can't. If we have everyone leaving, then everyone's going to die on the road. And we're shifting the distribution of risk from having a bunch of people scattered in an area where a tornado could cross it and we could kill a certain fraction of those people, to putting all of our eggs in a basket in the most vulnerable situation they can be in a car. And we're increasing the potential for catastrophic outcomes. So that's the Pandora's box we're opening with increasing lead time. And some of the survey work Harold was referring to earlier did suggest people would be more inclined to flee if they had more time. It might be that there's a systematic preference to not be in the way of a tornado if you think you can help it, and people might just be blind to the collective action problem of getting that done, especially in urban areas. As we urbanize places where there are tornadoes, like the plains, that could be an increasing problem.
Just a bit of context for those of you not from the area. In the 2013 example that Kim showed the photos of, one of the local weathercasters jumped on the air and basically said, leave your home, you have enough time.
Drive south.
So people drove south, and the storm dove southward, and the storm went right over them. So if the storm, fortunately the tornado, this is the one that killed the three storm chasers, including Tim Samaras. The storm lost its tornado right before it hit Interstate 35, but it literally could have been a catastrophe.
Well, so. And I think one of our, actually the May 31st to me brings up such a whole set of issues, because we had had violent tornadoes in Oklahoma City metropolitan area on the 19th and 20th of May, and we'd actually been in tornado watches with storms on the 28th, 29th, and 30th, the 3 days before, and there were a lot of people who were ready to freak out at a cloud on that day. I think that's one of those things that I wish I knew how much of that response was because somebody said something that they shouldn't have said, and how much of it was, okay, it's Friday afternoon, 5 o'clock, the roads are kind of packed anyway, and how much of it was essentially community trauma.
Yeah.
from the previous 2 weeks.
There's a fantastic analogy in my mind, and that's Hurricane Rita 10 years ago, which occurred a month after Hurricane Katrina. And of course, Rita headed toward Houston, mass evacuation, mass tie-ups, and more people died from the evacuation than anything else in Hurricane Rita. One final question. We just have like 2 minutes left. Yep.
It's storm chasing, I guess. It depends on the connotation and the way you. So we actually have a class at our college, essentially a thunderstorm lab, where we're educating people on the atmosphere, right? And we're going out and we're doing field work and that sort of stuff, and we're launching weather balloons. And the role of a chaser, and it's highly personal. It depends on the person. There are people that go out to spot for the National Weather Service and try to get ground truth. There are other folks who are out there to try to get the money shot for sensationalism and other purposes to try to make money. You have the whole gamut. You have the educational, you have the researchers out there, and you have the people that are out there just because they enjoy the atmosphere. So reporting on storm chasing is always interesting to see those articles come out. And it really depends on the writer. It depends on the person that you're interviewing. It's very highly dependent. But there's a lot of good, and there's also a lot of bad.
I would recommend an article originally in Westward in Denver, but it was syndicated through New Times Media about the Temsamaris, this 2013 tornado. A really wonderfully written piece. He talked to Tim's wife and all sorts of folks.
Even on the good aspect, what you are seeing now is just a huge exponential growth in the number of people that are out there viewing storms, and it's creating these small country roads that are non-paved, and you have hundreds of people out there, and they become flooded. And that aspect, there's been a big uptick in that in the recent decade. And that makes huge challenges even from an educational standpoint. And it's like, where do you draw the line in terms of weighing your risk of being out there versus what knowledge you're actually gaining?
And I'll say one thing. I occasionally hear chasers saying, well, I'm out there providing information that helps save lives on that event. That's nonsense. I mean, most of the events that kill people, the Weather Service is well aware of what's going on, and that chaser from out of town, that they have no idea what the quality of information they're getting from him. You know, they aren't going to take over their trained spotter that they personally trained and is telling them, we've got a large tornado on the ground. They're going to believe that over, you know, for instance, Victor being in Nebraska, you know, and if they don't know who Victor is, this is just some random guy calling them. And so I think that's one of the things is that, and that wasn't to pick on you at all, but that if I went to Nebraska, it'd be the same thing. I'm just some guy from out of town, but I don't really believe those sort of high motives that people claim at times for today. Maybe what Victor learned is going to help save lives 20 years from now, but I don't think it's going to help save lives 20 minutes from now.
Yeah, that's a very important distinction. Also, just for those of you who aren't familiar with the distinction between chasers and spotters are folks trained by their local weather services. They go to one spot basically and stay there and watch the storm come in and report. And that tradition goes all the way back more than 50 years, I believe, that program. Anyway, thank you guys. We're out of time. Let's thank our speakers.